KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherr's on sabbatical till October. If you opened your newspaper the last couple of days, banner headlines have told us that the government has a whole lot more information about us than we ever thought we were giving them, from tapping Verizon phone lines to today's revelations in the New York Times or last night's that the National Security Agency has been collecting all sorts of internet data. It's got a lot of people wondering how, why, and when did it all start? And we've got our panel of journalists here. We're also going to hear President Obama's response in just a second. But here they are, the regular gang, back again. Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com. And Eli Sanders, the associate editor at The Stranger's, back with us. Nice to have all three of you.
Nice to be back.
There you go.
Well,
morning.
Let's just dive in with President Obama. He had not addressed this issue at all yesterday. He's in California to meet the president of China, but I guess by popular demand. So let's hear what the president had to say.
Nobody is listening to your telephone calls. That's not what this program's about. What the intelligence community is doing is looking at phone numbers and durations of calls. They are not looking at people's names, and they're not looking at content.
Well, I don't know. Do you guys feel reassured by that?
No. The New York Times put it very well this morning in their editorial. You can get a lot of information with a phone number. And so if he says that they're just looking at phone numbers and durations of calls, well, there's a lot that you can glean from that.
Is this an expansion in recent years of a program that already existed, something that the Obama administration started, something the Bush?
It started with the Bush administration. It appears that it has been expanded upon by the Obama administration, but probably just because the technology and the available information has grown and their reliance on it apparently has grown. I think it's a very fascinating debate that we're going to have in this country here because, you know, on the one hand, you're not supposed to talk like this on the one hand and the other hand,
yeah,
but here we go. On the one hand, you have a population that expects, wants the government to stop and block terrorism and do a good job and maybe a better job than it did in Boston. And on the other hand, you have all this information that some people have known about. At least two U.S. senators had been writing cryptically about it, Ron Wyden and Mark Udall of Colorado, Wyden of Oregon. And so you have all this data collection. So as the president says, they're not exactly listening into the phone call, but they are observing time, you know, duration of call, the frequency of calls. This bit about they don't know your name is silly because right next to the phone number, take you about 40 seconds to get, or less than that probably, to get to the name. And so we are going to have a debate royale here about, you know, I want to be safe and I want my privacy. Oh my gosh, this is just going to pull on everything. You know, if you think about it, you know that all of you folks who have Google mail, that they crawl, I think that's the right word, across that for information that, oh my gosh, she wants to buy a dress. Oh my gosh, she's getting a hotel in some city. And so this has been building. Very interesting.
I'll bet you the stories on the in the media have not deterred 99% of the people who read them from using their phone, using Facebook, or sending an email about this or anything. Well,
probably else. Linking to the story and putting it on Facebook.
That's right. I mean, the cat is out of the bag as far as privacy as we used to know it, the technology. And, I mean, you know, and you hear now business, you know, touting business in Puget Sound, the importance of big data and these companies that can crunch these huge, you know, take vast quantities of data and find patterns. And this has been going on for years, in the private sector in particular. I went to one of the very first conferences on database marketing in, I think it was 1989, 88, 89. And at this conference, they were describing how marketers, what they could learn about people, individuals, as well as human behavior from completely legally available databases. So this is in the 1980s, pre, you know, when the internet was not ubiquitous and all of that. And it was shocking. Yeah. I mean, it was absolutely shocking at what, U.S. West or whoever could find out about you. And I remember one of the presenters who worked for an ad agency just sort of laughed nervously after doing this big presentation. And she said, oh, it's a good thing Hitler didn't have this.
Wow.
That the capabilities have, you know, increased exponentially since then. They've been in private hands, certainly, and we know that they're in government hands. And I think the idea of a public debate about this is fine. But I have the feeling that a huge chunk of the American public doesn't care anymore. They're used to it. They don't expect that kind of privacy, or they are willing to trade off data collection in exchange for a sense of safety.
Exactly. So, you know, we've talked about many times on this show in regard to police about how everybody's filming everything. So, you know, that even plays into the Boston Marathon thing, the surveillance tapes. But there is a trade-off. And I am very interested in the way that you phrase that, Skip, because there will be a calculation made in people's minds. What am I buying by giving this up? And remember, a whole generation of people are willingly giving up promoting information about themselves that maybe they should or shouldn't. I had a question when I was reading all this. So all these years when we're talking about, you know, the government protecting us from terrorists, they say, well, in the security threat is raised because of the chatter. What exactly was the chatter anyway? What did we all think it was? Was it them listening in on conversations? Because as Obama says, they don't tap the phone calls. They're not listening to the content unless they go get a subpoena, which means they are listening.
Mm-hmm.
And then where is the chatter exactly in all this? That maybe came from this, from the original, you know, crunching the metadata and then getting a subpoena where you had a red flag and listening.
Right. The chatter would only be, we would hope, from getting a warrant to listen in on a conversation. And then I think Joni hit on exactly what this is about. It's about finding patterns and making associations between people by data mining. And, that, like Knut says, that's a very, very powerful tool. It's been used for private companies. It also has been used, for example, by the Seattle Times in the Pulitzer Prize-winning piece that they did on methadone fatalities. That's data mining and making associations that were helpful to the public. But there's something, I think, as we see, you know, differing reactions among the public about this, I think we're going to see a split based on age. I think the people who Knut's referring to who have less of a traditional expectation of privacy are going to be younger. And people who are older and spent most of their lives dealing with landline telephones and kind of the just intense intimacy of that conversation are going to have a very different perspective on this. But in general, I think the intimacy of voice-to-voice communication is different than posting on Facebook, sending a G-chat, and so people are they're not going to easily accept this.
So there's the issue of us as citizens, but as these revelations about the Obama administration have hit the headlines, like it seems like at least weekly, sometimes daily, you know, devolves into this partisan kind of squabbling. This particular issue, it seems to me, is not so easily pegged, is it?
No, I don't think it is. I mean, obviously, civil libertarians on the left and right are going to be very upset about it.
Right.
But I don't think even for them it's completely unexpected, because the Patriot Act passed. It was renewed. People have read and analyzed what that allows the government to do. And even though there are courts and Congress have roles in overseeing that it's not abused, they can't say anything about what they've seen or what they've approved. So there's this sort of secret world. And I think what I'm saying is that there's one of the issues is what's legal. In other words, these programs, at least on the surface, we may find out more, but on the surface, we're told that they're entirely legal under the Patriot Act. So one of the problems is legally is what's legal. The second part of it is, even if something is legal, it can be abused. The IRS scandal is a great example of no matter who you elect or who you trust in office, whether you feel more secure with a George W. Bush in office or a Barack Obama, there are abuses. If that power exists, if the data exists, if the information exists, there's a temptation to cross lines. And we saw that with Reagan and Iran-Contra and others. Mm-hmm. There's always that temptation. That's what happens with power. The generational thing is interesting because they're almost two sides of a coin, in that you have this sort of massive government data mining on the one hand and surveillance on the one hand, and then you have WikiLeaks on the other. I mean, the technology is empowering people to do to government what government is doing to other people. And that's kind of a really interesting, you know, battlefield in and of itself.
Well, and also politically, this is not, you know, the traditional Democrat versus Republican. What you have is the libertarians and the lefties sort of on one side, and then maybe folks in the middle. You know, so where else do you have Dianne Feinstein and Lindsey Graham? Just so you know,
I heard that yesterday.
That is just a really, you know, unique pairing of folks. You had Dianne Feinstein, pretty sorry.
I like that, DiFi.
Oh, they call her that. You know, pretty much defending it along with Lindsey Graham, but, you know, because they've known about it, I guess, for some period of time.
And I think a lot of people have known about it.
And explaining, hey, you know, this is all about protecting Americans. We don't listen in, as Obama said. We just, you know, we just follow the patterns. And so we have, that's what's so fascinating about it. It's not a traditional Democrat versus Republican issue.
Well, one of the things that we hear about in bits and pieces, but we don't get to hear about, and in some ways maybe shouldn't hear about, is when it's successful. In other words, because the more they reveal their tradecraft, the more people who want to do bad things can escape. And so there's this frustrating gap, because you have to trust people, and I'm putting trust in the air quotes there. You have to trust people, yet on the other hand, you know, they if you get that kind of unity, it suggests that people who've seen a lot of the detail think it's worth it. But that's scary, because there's no way to check that.
David on Capitol Hill writes, privacy, in those same air quotes, is a red herring when it's harassment for one's ethnicity or dissent in the guise of security. And this guise becomes as pernicious a threat as one from the outside. Knut Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders here talking over this gigantic story and many more. The list is long here on Weekday. We'll continue in a minute.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. This weekend, the I-5 on and off ramps at Mercer Street in Seattle will be closed. According to the Department of Transportation, the closure will begin tonight at 11, and those ramps should open again 5 o'clock Monday morning.
Support for KUOW comes from Sorticulture, Everett's Garden Arts Festival, a celebration of creative outdoor living in Legion Park, June 7th through the 9th, featuring handcrafted art and plants for the garden, live music, and kids' activities. More online at enjoyeverett.org.
Cloudy sky over Seattle this morning, and it's probably going to stay cloudy all day. Forecast says we might get a little bit of rain, and we're going to hit 71 for our high temperature this afternoon. A troubled nuclear power plant in California is being closed. We'll have more about that in the news at 11.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. On Fridays, we talk over the week's news with our panel of journalists, the regular gang back here, Associate Editor of The Stranger, Eli Sanders, Moss back at Crosscut.com, Knut Berger, and Seattle Times political editor, Joni Balter. I want to just talk about something that interested me and just touch on it briefly, which was how Chris Christie managed to handle replacing John Lautenberg and tiptoeing that fine political line between angering his own party, which he's done often, angering the Democrats. Instead, he angered everybody and took the middle line.
Okay. A, the idea of Chris Christie tiptoeing causes some troubles for me just as a visual.
You didn't like that.
But
okay.
But That said, I think he should become his own reality show because he is so always in the news. We're always talking about Chris Christie. This one was just, you know, he had, as I count them, three choices for what to do after longtime Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey died last Monday. So he could have had an election in November, which he was worried because there are 700,000 more registered Democrats in the great state of New Jersey.
And he's up for
re-election. And he's up, and he wanted big numbers so that he could ride into the 2016 presidential race, maybe, or probably, or one of those. And so the other idea was he could have waited till next year. That caused some problems with who would represent New Jersey. Or he could spend $25 million that he swore he'd never pay for an election on an October election that sort of doesn't allow for his own upstaging on the regular ballot. And he chose the one I just mentioned, the October expensive. And so everyone cut to right away to a quote from him not too long ago where he said, we don't have $25 million for, you know, a whole bunch of stuff that New Jerseyans, if that's the right word, want. And so, boy, he's in it. But the stories I've read said that he decided to take the sort of short-term heat for this, for the long-term gain of not looking bad in November and still having that sort of great election that takes him to 2016.
And so another clear reminder that he is running in 2016, mm-hmm. or at least he really intends to right now.
And he also appointed his longtime friend who says, I'm going to take the job for 5 months, the Attorney General of New Jersey, and then I'm not going to run. And that's it. So I don't know why I find him fascinating, Joni. Maybe it's a reality show of him. That's the light detour, unless, Knut, you have something you want to add.
No, I find him a fascinating character, too.
Yeah.
He's just, yeah, an interesting political person to watch.
Because he's so in your face. I mean, that's the thing, especially, you know, that he, you know, he got in so much trouble. He did the hug heard round the world when the president came after Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, he had the guts to hug a Democratic president in the heat of an election, you know, 10 or 12, whatever it was, 15 days before the election. And the hug aggravated Romney and supposedly gave the race to Obama.
Well, Mitt Romney was on CNN this week. In fact, yeah, I think last night, saying that he sure wished that hurricane had not happened right before the election. But apparently he insisted that he and Ann Romney are good with Chris Christie. He's a great guy. They don't blame him. They blame the hurricane. So apparently it was inconveniently timed, and apparently his money couldn't convince Mother Earth to send it at a different time of year.
I think part of the fascination with Chris Christie is just that he's so much himself. So many politicians are so controlled, so scripted, and he is impulsive, tempestuous, and just unapologetic for who he is, and you really can't pigeonhole him very well. So he becomes fascinating, and in a reality show kind of way, there is always this question of what is Christie going to do next?
Well, it also reminds you how contained and managed all the rest of our political leaders are.
Contrast him with Obama, whose main selling point in a lot of ways, or at least during the campaign, was how cool he was mm-hmm. and how unruffled he would be.
Well, let's talk about other political appointments. After months of, you know, will he go, Aaron Reardon went on Friday, and it took, I don't know, a couple hours for the Snohomish County Council to appoint the guy that everybody thought was going to get the job, the former sheriff, John Lovick, who told us on Monday that he plans to be highly visible and visit every employee of Snohomish County, and has got an open door policy, which apparently is the opposite of what his predecessor had.
Well, once Reardon got in trouble, he hunkered down, so there really wasn't much access to him. And so once you do that, the opposite of that, and something people would probably like, would be just everything's open. John Lovick has a history in Snohomish County. He was a legislator. He was a trooper. He was a sheriff.
Kind of been everything.
And he's very beloved up there. And so he gets to come in and do everything that Reardon didn't. So it looks like he's very much, you know, it took him a very short period of time to name him and unanimous vote. So that takes some of the question mark that has been hanging over Snohomish County gets to go away.
Also, an appointment to fill Pete Carroll's seat down in the legislature. Also, unanimous approval of Mike O'Bann. Steve O'Bann, I'm sorry.
Steve O'Bann and Mike Carroll.
Mike Carroll.
Which, to jump very quickly
sorry,
from
Pete
the
Carroll's
human,
a football coach.
From the human story to the crass political calculation, but since this is politics, it returns.
Oh, Eli, you don't do that.
Never. It returns the Senate to the sort of stalemate that it was in before.
In fact, I haven't seen a paper since this morning. I suppose I could look at it right now. We have, 5 days left in this first extra legislative session. I've decided not to use the word special anymore.
Because it's not that special to you, is
and
it?
as far as I know, the 11th is the deadline, and all signs point to number two.
Well, no. All signs point to some movement in the
last day
or two.
Okay.
Well, first of all, the House passed a revised budget, which eliminates, cuts back on some of the education spending, some other state spending, and eliminates the extension, proposed extension of some of the taxes that were due to expire, the beer tax, and I think one of the B&O, one of the business taxes.
Has gone away now, too.
So they've taken that out. So the House did a public, we passed this revised proposal. Here it is. We've taken a big step toward the Republican budget. It's time for them to step up. I saw word last night that the Republicans have made a private counteroffer, but Rodney Tom, who heads the Senate coalition, says we're not going to negotiate in the press, so he's not revealing what that counteroffer was. I was at a forum with Rodney Tom, was one of the speakers at on Tuesday, I guess. Was that Tuesday?
Wednesday
night. And Tom said that he thought that they were making progress and that a special session wasn't absolutely in the works, that things could come together in a couple of days, perhaps. I mean, I'll believe that when I see it. But there is progress being made. There are talks going on.
And that actually would be special if they solved the budget with only one extra session, because, as you said, Marcy, given the history over the last few years, there is nothing unusual about it taking two extra sessions for the legislature to do its job.
So I think we're not going to call it special session anymore. We're just going to call it extra session. One big interesting piece of news, not related to the legislature, but nonetheless interesting, was that Army Staff Sergeant Robert Bales this week, for the first time, took the stand under oath and confessed to the 16 murders of Afghan civilians of which he'd been accused, apparently part of a plea deal, and he would avoid the death penalty. I'm not anyone to say that I understand the military judicial system, but apparently what happens again in August is that he reappears in front of a tribunal who decide his fate.
Whether he's going to get life. The question is with or without parole.
Right.
And, he has this high profile attorney, John Henry Brown, who saved his life by this deal. There's no other way to say it. I thought that the testimony was just so jarring and troubling when you read it, of how he was saying, yes, these horrible things happened. And they walked him through the whole darn thing. They seem to be saying, hey, too many assignments to the war zone for this person, not using that as a direct excuse, but as a mitigating kind of factor.
I'm reading this, just about finished with this terrific book on World War II, The War in Europe, called The Guns at Last Light. It's about the invasion of Europe and the Battle of the Bulge, and doesn't shy away from admitting and talking about the massive numbers of war crimes that were committed on all sides. But American troops raped and pillaged and murdered, along with being extremely brave and noble and everything, all mixed into one. War produces these horrible things. That's not to excuse what this guy did. And in fact, there are many people who work under the exact same conditions that he worked under in terms of taking these drug cocktails to keep them going. I didn't realize USGIs took amphetamines.
Me either.
And
know,
there were steroids in
places like that.
Yeah. But in this case, steroids.
In this case, he had steroids. He also, you know, probably had PTSD. And you just realize, I mean, that whole that thing about war being hell, it really is hell. There really is a lot of, and this is really shined a light on one of the just darkest places you can go in war. And I think the lesson that you take away from it is that when you decide to go to war, you're making a decision that these kinds of things will happen. Mm-hmm. They are inevitable. They happen of one kind or another in every war because of what the chaotic and rolling and what it brings out in people is, and that you really have to think about the totality of that. As much as you might try to fight a war by the rules, there are going to be people who go beyond that. And, you know, it's hard to imagine that any punishment is enough.
I really agree with what Knut said, and it's when you're dealing with that number of people put into that kind of an awful situation, there's just going to be some natural variability and then huge unpredictability in how people are going to respond to it. And again, it is not in any way to excuse the 14 deaths at the man at this man's hand. 16, sorry. But if there is any light to come out of what is just a horrible tragedy for all involved, it is the opportunity to see more clearly what Knut is describing.
Another sort of tangent on it, not so tangential, is that the families of the victims wanted him to hang for this, and they have vowed vengeance. I think the number I heard was 100 deaths to avenge this. And it got me to thinking about the precarious role of U.S. troops and consultants in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in that whole region of the world. Anyway, we're on our way out. You know, what does this all mean about not just for the young men and women who are sent to fight the battles, but also for what this country theoretically stands for?
Well, that's exactly what the protesters who were saying. They don't understand how he doesn't face the death penalty. That's how it resonates for them. And, you know, that is haunting if you think about it.
It's also a contrast in justice systems. What these families in Afghanistan are talking about is the justice system that they are used to. And so they don't understand why ours doesn't operate in that same way, and we don't. What they're describing is foreign to us because of our justice system. And it's when you're asking, you know, about what we stand for, actually the process that he has gone through is an example of what at least the American justice system tries to stand for.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that he's put so many helped to put. He's not the sole cause by any means, but this kind of thing puts your colleagues at risk. Exactly. You put mm-hmm. the diplomats,
right.
You put the aid workers, you put anybody connected with the Western coalition or who wants to attempt to live up to American values. You put those people at risk, and that's just a really unfortunate outcome.
We're talking over the week's news with Knut Berger, Joni Balter, and Eli Sanders. And I think we'll take a little break. It's hard to talk about other things right after that. And then we'll be back talking about the Seattle mayor's race that some people don't know is happening here on Weekday on KUOW.
KUOW and ACT Theater present An Evening with Groucho. The audience becomes part of the show as Frank Ferrante improvises his way through this comedy in true Groucho style. And no two shows are ever the same. June 13th through the 30th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
60 degrees in Seattle. The National Weather Service says we're going to reach 71 this afternoon. It's going to be mostly cloudy all day with the chance of rain.
Support for KUOW comes from Hillside Student Community School, dedicated to teaching students grades 5 through 12 to think critically and creatively and to embrace their future with confidence. College prep, small classes in Bellevue. Currently accepting applications for grades 5 and 6. More at hillsidesc.org.
1036. I'm Bernard Ouellette. President Obama is meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping today and tomorrow. We'll take a look at what they're expected to talk about and what, if anything, might come of this meeting in 30 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday, and we're talking over the week's news with our journalist roundtable, Joni Balter, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders. I'm Marcy Silman, and our reporter Deb Wong did a story this week about the invisible mayoral race. She was out in a park in town and asked random voting age people whether they knew that we had an election in less than 2 months, I believe, if I'm not sure of the exact date, but just about 2 months from now. There's a mayoral primary. There are 9 candidates, I believe, on the ballot since Tim Burgess dropped out. And a lot of these people randomly selected said what?
Well, in fairness to that voter that you're referring to, you know, we have made our primary earlier and earlier. And so it does kind of sneak up on people. It's early August. And, you know, for a long, long time, primaries were in September and then they were in later in August. And so now they're very early August. So it really does punch it back up, you know, to a time. But I think a few more weeks and folks will realize that there are 9 people out there trying to lead the city. It's usually, you know, the stories have not been front page for some reason. They've been the head at the top of the local or the bottom of the local or somewhere mm-hmm. there. But there is, and Skip had a good phrase at the Civic Cocktail the other evening where he said it's in the mushy phase because they're all talking and it's 9 people talking and it's sort of hard to narrow it when it's that big of a number. But there are some sort of, you know, better known candidates to avoid all traps here and lesser known candidates. And so it will begin its shaking down process. I think it is as we speak, but just not a lot of people know that.
Well, it was interesting because Deb Wong was talking about endorsements and the importance of that and who's got endorsements. And the other part is who's got money. One candidate who cannot raise money at this point is Ed Murray, who was one of the, you know, big names on that docket of 9, and he is legally prevented from raising money because the legislature has been in session for a really long time.
He probably has an even more elaborate name for special sessions. But
very unspecial.
But what we saw this week, because he can't raise money until after the budget wrangling is done and the special or unspecial sessions are over, there is an outside group that is coming in to spend unlimited money for Ed Murray in this race, which
was,
I think,
it Citizens for Ed Murray,
what? Something like that. Yeah. And I think that's going to be an interesting dynamic. Ed Murray has talked about campaign finance reform, and this is, I don't think, what he's talking about when he's talking about campaign finance reform. On the other hand, he is in a bind. And it's not bad as a politician to have a lot of people who want you so badly they're going to spend unlimited money in an independent expenditure.
Well, I spoke to one of the folks who helped organize that. And the point of that is, you know, here's Ed Murray. He's stuck. He can't raise money. It seems that some of the folks in the group, like, may have been Tim Burgess people before, but are now sort of coalescing around Ed Murray and realizing that, you know, he does have name familiarity, but so do some other folks like Peter Steinbrück, and how to level that whole business. So they decided they want to help him. And that's what this group is.
Now, I want you to talk a little bit about the mush and where you think it should be firmed up.
Well, you know, you go to these candidate forums and a lot of what you hear over and over again aren't significant policy differences. They tend to be the sort of rote little, you know, I was born in Seattle. I believe in the arts. You know, I believe in sustainability and we should have a honest police department. I mean, you know, it's very, and so what you really,
sounds good.
what you do get a sense of over time is some personality and somehow and so some people are making usually when you have this many candidates in the race, it's for an open seat. This is not an open seat. There's an incumbent. Although 6 months ago when they looked at his polling, they thought it was as good as open because he wasn't going to get McGinn wouldn't make it through. Everybody's had to reassess that. McGinn's doing better than expected. But he's still the guy that you have to make the case that he doesn't deserve to be mayor any longer. And that you have an alternative, and the wedge that they are using is not necessarily one on policy because they all believe in density and you know everything else, but leadership ability, and particularly if you want to get the business community behind you, you are going to make the argument on that end. And so Harrell, Stadecker, Murray, and McGinn himself are all kind of making arguments in that, and the business community is sort of dividing up over there. Then you have the other candidates who have a little bit more of a either leadership style or slight, you know, policy differences. Peter Steinbrück would probably be the most mainstream of those candidates, who's, you know, openly and really actively has been campaigning on the Soto arena as that's a bad idea, and it's representative of the bad leadership of the mayor because he's going in back rooms negotiating these deals and not we could be spending this city's capital elsewhere.
I was going to say, you know, look, in Seattle you have, when you have a mayor's race, you have 31 flavors of Democrats here. You know, who's more Democrat? So the policies aren't that different. And an interesting footnote to this race is that one guy who was definitely a Democrat, Tim Burgess, dropped out because he was just slightly, you know, the 31th flavor or something like that, because he years ago had been for a anti-panhandling law or something like that, and they had a couple other reasons why he wasn't attracting many of the sort of Democratic group support. So around here, you know, it does come down to style, not that much policy, although the one policy that Skip cited is an example of where the candidates tended to differ.
And on that style point, if you are among the few people in the city who are interested in going to all these forums and attending them regularly, you do start to see stylistic differences, dispositional differences. I think Knut touched on that this week in the piece he wrote about the forums that he's been to. And both Knut and I were at a forum on Monday night at Town Hall where they were talking about the arts. And as you said, everyone loves the arts. But you started to see, so there wasn't much light in that in terms of contrast, but you did start to see contrasting styles. And you started to see Ed Murray and Mike McGinn really effectively getting under each other's skin, I thought. You saw Mike McGinn trying to use Ed Murray's greatest strength, which is his experience in Olympia, as turn it into his biggest vulnerability, to tie Ed Murray to the dysfunction in Olympia, to tie Ed Murray to things that Olympia hasn't delivered for Seattle, and to say, wait a minute, if he's been so successful in Olympia, why don't we have this? Why don't we have that? And also it kind of implies, why don't we still want you down there if you're, you know, doing so great? And on the other hand, Ed will relentlessly talk about his ability to build partnerships and coalitions and work effectively with people. And that is obviously an attack on McGinn for his reputation as someone who's kind of bull in a china shop, stubborn, can't get along with people, and therefore isn't able to get things done.
Well, also, didn't McGinn say once that Ed is doing such a good job in Olympia, he should stay there?
It's a good line, even if he didn't say it. Michael wants to know why the mayor and other candidates are so quiet about homelessness, the camp that's Nicholsville down in southwest Seattle.
Because it's a problem that no one has a solution for. I think that is the real answer. Do you remember Ron Simms' plan to end homelessness however many years ago? I think he had...
It was the 10-year plan, and I think it's into its seventh year as we speak.
Is it?
I think so.
It's still underway?
There is a group, yes. It was led by Bill Block for many years, and then he stepped aside, and someone whose name escapes me at the moment stepped in.
It's
an ongoing effort.
Problem to solve, and the city actually lacks, I think, leadership from elected officials on this issue. They're kind of at a point where they've thrown up their hands. There's no one stepping forward and, like Ron, saying, I have a plan and we are going to fix this. There are a lot of people on the council saying, we don't know what to do about Nicholsville.
Well, in the meantime, there's so much assorted problems, not just with where they're located, but sanitation and crime and reported drug dealing. People have said they've seen it. I have not, but you know, I've certainly read about it.
But this is an issue in the mush of the mayor's race, because they're all talking about how to sort of make downtown, you know, desirable, stopping short, it seems, all the candidates of the panhandling law that was considered a couple of years ago. And then McGinn comes out and defends himself and says, look, you know, charter bookings, the cruises are up, the hotel stays are up, downtown's vibrant, while on the other hand saying that he's got a project down in Belltown designed to try to make that place feel a little safer.
I was interested. I'm looking right now at Danny Westneat's column in the Times of June the 3rd. So I'm not June the 1st. I think it appeared Sunday originally. Uh-huh. And it was about the sort of two cities that we have devolved, or maybe have always been in the city of sort of, you know, high profile money, gentrification, all the things that go with it. Right next door to ongoing problems of crime, gang violence in this town. We've been hearing stories about the release of the older generation of gangsters coming back out onto the streets and then trying to get their turf back from the younger generation.
The Seattle Times had a story about how, you know, and I've seen this story before, like two or three years ago, but it does sort of go in cycles where you have some gang members are behind bars and then it's a little bit of quiet. Then their time comes due, they're out, and it increases, or they redraw the boundaries of these, you know, gang territories. So apparently there's a bit of a resurgence, and Danny was trying to address that.
Yeah. And I think it was a good column. I mean, there are two cities, at least in the respect that he was talking about. And I think that's one of the things that Bruce Harrell, a city councilman who's running for mayor, that's something you hear him address mm-hmm. in his campaign, talking about there's only one Seattle. I want to bring people together. I want there to be one Seattle. And that's basically a way he's saying that he wants South Seattle enfranchised fully in terms of arts, in terms of police, in terms of political power and that kind of thing. And that message, I think, has resonance. Other candidates speak to it as well. But I think Bruce Harrell has made that kind of a cornerstone of his campaign.
To return to the homelessness issue for a minute in the mayoral race, and just to show you how closely people involved are following this, even if people in the parks are not, I just heard from someone close to the mayor who says, wait a minute, the mayor's office just sent down legislation to help deal with the Nicholsville issue. They're working with Licata and O'Brien, and that's true. Licata has been pushing a solution, but as a whole, the council has not been able to coalesce around anything. But the mayor's preferred option is to provide residents a package of services and to allow encampments on non-religious private property and not just religious institutions. And Tim Harris, who's obviously key in all this, supports that.
That is good PR, whoever did that.
He's reading from his phone. See,
the NSA now.
I was going to say, NSA. The NSA knows, Eli, that you are.
They know what you're thinking.
That you're hooked in.
Exactly.
Well, you know, to get back to this idea of mushiness and defining oneself in a race with nine candidates, what is the leading issue, do you think, that the voters are going to make their decision on in August?
I think it's a lot about leadership. I don't think that, you know, you're talking about voters who don't even know there's an election coming. I think when they pay attention and they want their basic services, you know, they want their potholes filled, they want their streets to move a little bit, the lights to be synchronized. I always thought that was one of the funnier ones. What do they do? Just take them out of the box and hang them up, you know? Well, I thought they were synchronized. Crazy. But, you know, they just want sort of a basic sense that the city is being managed from the top. Their day-to-day interactions with the city have to just run smoothly. They can't see a city that's sort of fighting itself on all these many issues.
Knut and Eli, do you agree that's the top priority?
Yeah, I do. I think that's the kind of thing that doesn't, so far hasn't been resonating, except in these general critique of leadership. But the nobody's really running a pothole campaign. Nobody. I mean, we've had candidates who've run pothole campaigns.
Yes, we have.
We have had candidates who've run law and order campaigns. And this time that you don't have people who break out in those distinct ways. You have Peter Steinbrück talks about the neighborhoods. That tends to be code for, wanting to keep quality of life at an issue, which means not massive density everywhere, or enfranchising people who are not downtown. Mm-hmm. And that's another way these elections often break down, is that you end up with a downtown candidate and a non-downtown candidate. That's happened plenty of times.
Yeah. Who is the downtown candidate?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think downtown yet agrees. I mean, we've seen money go to McGinn. We've seen money go to Burgess. We've seen Stedeker's race.
Well, Charlie Stedeker is the businessman in the race. So there's a little bit of a component there. But the business community here is spread across.
Right. Ed Murray. Right.
I think independent expenditure in part suggests that Ed Murray is becoming the downtown
candidate. Well, Knut, you wrote a column about the conservatives and how, as Joni said earlier, Tim Burgess was the 31st flavor, slightly
too much
more,
PR for Baskin and Robbins.
Yeah, slightly more conservative, perhaps, than some of these other candidates.
Right.
And so then it's mushy because we've kind of floated in that direction that in Seattle and the Seattle area, we want a certain kind of political definition, which has led to, you know, the antithesis of that is the Tea Party. There isn't sort of a mainstream that wants us to get its neck out.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we literally, in many respects, we are a one-party town. It's everybody, almost everybody is a Democrat. We have one Socialist Worker Party candidate in the race. She makes it very clear she wants us to be like Cuba and for global revolution. But everybody else is sort of in a fairly traditional left, maybe some tiptoe into Nader territory. But basically, it's a Democratic town. It wasn't always that way. Seattle used to have – Republicans used to be dominant at one point. I was just looking the other day at the race of 1900. Okay. So, okay, this is
you
how
You do know
I,
how to spend your
this
time.
Is,
you
hey,
do.
And this was
you
my
do.
Leisure time. This is my leisure time. Here were the parties, the candidates running for mayor. There were six candidates running for mayor. There was a Democrat, a gold standard Republican, a silver Republican, a populist, a people's candidate who had been nominated by a crowd by acclamation, and a socialist.
If you take out the Democrat, it sounds like the Republican presidential primary.
You know, we got to buy Skip a time machine. That's what he needs.
I want to know what's the difference between a gold and a silver Republican.
Well,
the gold
Republicans were the kind of traditional pro-business Republicans who believed in the gold standard.
I see.
And the silver Republicans were kind of liberal Republicans who peeled off and were supporters of William Jennings Bryan's free silver based currency.
Wow.
But it's kind of the difference between.
And they were running for mayor?
Yes. Yeah. And in those days, the parties held nominating conventions. So it was partisan office. People got together. They chose you to run. Sometimes there were fusion tickets where parties came together and agreed on a candidate. Let's just say if we like diversity, if we like we like that kind of intellectual ferment, we had it 100 years ago. The last time a Republican seriously contended for the mayor's race was Doug Jewett in 1989. He was beaten by Norm Rice.
I stopped when I read that. I couldn't remember if Doug called himself a Republican.
Yes,
he was certainly more conservative.
Okay. No, he did.
Yeah.
But in that mayor's race, he downplayed it.
Oh,
but
okay.
He
Maybe
had
that's
been,
what
but
I remember.
He was a partisan Republican before that. Yeah.
Well, speaking of Republicans, we can end on this. The Republican gubernatorial candidate launched his new nonprofit, and you talked to Randy Peppel this week, who was the campaign manager. He says that this isn't an election kind of thing. He's not running right. Well, he's running for something, right? Rob McKenna.
It's all a mystery. But what's not a mystery is that he's going to keep his name out there. He's going to be involved in civic affairs. he's not saying what he's going to run for or if he's going to run for anything someday, but I don't think anybody in their right mind would think his public career is over.
I think that if you launch a website like that and you have all the same folks in place, it's a way of, you can't announce now that you're running for governor. I mean, you can't, because then
people have announced that they're running for president.
I realize that, but it would be so cumbersome for Rob McKenna to say now that he's a candidate for 2016. But what he can say is, you know, I'm watching, I'm active, I'm interested in politics and the community. He's also become quite a tweeter. His wife, I don't know if you can say this, she out-tweeted him for many months, and he started to get into it.
Yeah, I was going to say this could all be him having to find some way to compete with his wife's very popular Twitter following.
What does she tweet about?
Oh, everything. All kinds of stuff.
And she has a lot of followers. And she has, actually, she has a very interesting Twitter feed and is more interesting than her husband in a lot of ways, more politically interesting, more engaging in terms of willing to mix it up with people who disagree with her.
She is more outspoken than he about things. She's sort of teasing it out of him in a way. It's kind of interesting.
Is she the Chris
watch.
Christie of that pair?
Yes. Well, how do I say this?
That's not a reference to physical stature.
She, yeah.
Just the opposite for her. She lost 120 pounds and has just become
right.
absolute rabid dog runner. You know, she's running in the, you know, 15
Super
miles
fit.
And stuff. Yeah. And so that is actually part of the story.
Does she have political aspirations?
I hadn't known about that. I don't know.
It's unclear.
So we don't know if either of them has
We know one of them.
We know Rob has aspirations. The question is, what, you know,
how organized is he at this moment?
What they are. I mean, Pepl has said pretty explicitly he's not running for governor in 2016, but there are lots of other things he could run for. I mean, they're
Senator,
Congress.
He has name recognition.
Other things, so.
I know that you all be watching that, but you know, we'll be circling back to the Seattle mayoral race at the very least, because if you are listening and you did not know, there is a primary and it's the first Tuesday in August, and I'm sure that you'll be getting your ballots in the mail in the next 4 weeks or so.
They come in mid-July.
Mid-July, so you can start thinking about it now. We've got coverage of the election ongoing at our website, the Seattle Times, Crosscut, and The Stranger do as well. Our guests, nice to have you all back here, the regular panel, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, Knute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com, and Joni Balter, assistant political editor for The Seattle Times. Nice to have all three of you here with us. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Claim cellist Joshua Roman joins us Monday on Weekday. Hope you will, too.
The movement continues here in the Northwest to make parents who don't want to have their children immunized get approval from their doctor. We'll have more on that in the news in a moment. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
KUOW and Book It Repertory Theater present The Financial Lives of the Poets, June 7th to 13th at the University of Washington's Jones Playhouse. Jess Walter's comic novel depicts one middle-aged guy's hapless attempts to keep his American dream from going up in smoke. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
This Week in This American Life.
Excuse me. Sorry to bother you. But I just have to tell you, I love your voice. Excuse me. I'm sorry to bother you. But I just have to tell you. I love your... Excuse me.
The episode that we did on stage and beamed into movie theaters everywhere, Tig Notaro and others, this week.
You can hear that exactly 24 hours from now, tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Science Festival, presenting Our 11th Hour, straight talk on climate change from people who know, June 15th at Seattle Rep.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners.
Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.